This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peek. Have you ever wondered what actually keeps a patient safe while they're under anesthesia? Temperature is one of the biggest hidden risks in the operating room. Our guest this morning, Adam Hauke, is the Global Director of Product Strategy and Innovation at Gentherm Medical, where he leads global research and development teams shaping innovation across the company's medical device business.
At Gentherm, Adam's team has tackled a problem hiding in plain sight: patient warming and patient positioning in the operating room. They've been traditionally treated as two separate problems with two separate devices. But as it turns out, that letting a patient's core temperature drop below 96.8 degrees during surgery is a surprisingly common risk under anesthesia. His team's answer combines both functions into a single system using conductive carbon fiber heating built directly into the surgical pad itself. Adam Hauke, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here. I love talking about, as an engineer, I love talking about engineering and science. So this is the perfect outlet for me. Thank you.
Well, great. Let's jump into it, because like most people, I had no idea that getting cold is even a risk during surgery. Can you explain what's going on with hypothermia and what it actually is? And why is it so easily vulnerable, maybe during anesthesia?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something very easy to overlook, Scott. Under normal circumstances, a patient's core temperature will run about 2 to 4 degrees Celsius cooler than their peripheral tissue. And when I talk about peripheral tissue, I'm talking about the arms, the legs, and the skin around your entire body. Your core would be made up of your, you know, your trunk and your head. And your body controls this temperature differential by regulating blood flow in the skin, okay? So this is the reason why fingers and toes tend to get frostbite a lot faster than other parts of your body. So for instance, if I'm climbing on Mount Everest and I'm getting very cold, my body is going to naturally close or constrict my skin blood vessels in order to keep blood flow out into my peripheral tissue. What that does is it conserves, since the blood is actually carrying the thermal energy with it, it keeps the warmer blood from the core in the core, protecting your vital organs rather than flowing out to your peripheral tissue. All right, so that's the body's mechanism against protecting its organs in an emergency situation. What happens during surgery is that when a patient undergoes anesthesia, the anesthetics affect the patient's hypothalamus, which affect their ability to thermoregulate. And essentially what happens is that it lowers the threshold for that skin, the skin blood vessel constriction and dilation. So essentially what happens is when you undergo the anesthesia, your skin blood vessels open up, blood is free to flow everywhere, and that warmer blood and temperature from your core mixes with everything out in the peripheral, which is cooler. And essentially that mixing is what makes the body's temperature drop. So there's a common misconception that this is, very cold ORs, which do contribute, but the common misconception is that patients are just sort of, you know, losing all of this energy out to the very cold environment, when in truth, the major contributor to patient hypothermia is this mixing of blood within the body.
Wow. And it has been traditionally been treated with two separate devices, if I read the bio correctly. What is different about what you're developing? And
sure.
Why? Well, actually, can you start from the beginning and tell us
sure.
why we have two devices and then maybe what's
yeah.
going on with your device?
Absolutely. So patient warming traditionally has been done with air-moving devices. So convective warmers, essentially they are air blowers, sort of like you can think of them like a hairdryer, but much, much more bulky and powerful. So what these products do is warm air and move them out through a blanket that lays over the patient with an air permeable layer and moves that warm air around the patient in order to warm their periphery, warm that blood that's going to be mixing and then keep that patient warm. I think the second device that you were talking about, Scott, is devices that are used to hold patients in place for Trendelenburg. So Trendelenburg position is when in a surgery, and this is very common in robotic and minimally invasive surgery, where the patient is actually inclined on a table, okay? So Trendelenburg position would be when the patient's feet are lifted above their head typically no greater than 40 degrees. And then reverse Trendelenburg will be when the head is lifted above the feet. So it's a little counterintuitive there on the Trendelenburg versus reverse. But essentially what the clinicians are trying to do is move anatomy out of the way to gain access to a site, okay? So if you can imagine in minimally invasive surgery, you have cannulas, very small ports in your body so that the surgeon can insert tools in and also a camera so they can see what they are working on, okay? They lose their ability to be able to move things out of the way. So if you have an organ laying over the organ that they want to work on, it's very hard to bring in another instrument in order to move that out of the way. So they essentially will tip you up and use gravity to move that anatomy out of the way to access the site that they want to affect. What's typically used to hold those patients very tightly in position and have them A, not slide off of the bed, but also B, hold them very, very tightly in position so that even, you know, the smallest slip could not occur. Because what would occur in that small slip is that the camera, which is in one of these cannulas, gets knocked off of its axis, and then the surgeon can't see what they're working on. So in order to hold them very tightly into that position, foam pads are used to hold them very tightly in position on that operating room table. So that these foam pads require very good contact with the patient's skin and very good contact with the operating room table. I know that was a long-winded explanation there. The reason it's very difficult to use these two solutions together is because of the last thing that I said about the foam pad. It requires very good skin contact and very good contact with the bed because it's using the coefficient of friction to hold that patient in place. So during robotic and minimally invasive surgery, you typically have cannulas and robots and things like that all over the top of the patient where we would typically put a warming blanket to warm them from the top. So in those situations, we have underbody warming blankets for convective that we would put under the patient and the air would blow out from underneath them. But because of the need for the skin contact and the requirements of the foam pads, we cannot use that. Otherwise, it would create slippage on the patient. So this is where for robotic and minimally invasive surgery, there is a large gap in using these two devices together. They're both competing for the same real estate that we have on the patient to be able to warm them and secure them. And typically the result of that is clinicians are having to choose one or the other, or you know, put these air blankets together in unconventional ways that they weren't really meant to serve in order to keep that patient warm.
Adam, this is a fascinating conversation. You know, here in Park City, I think anyone who's got a car with a seat heater and or a steering wheel heater will say they will never have a car without the two of those.
Me too. I'm in Ohio and I will say me too.
Oh, it's such a wonderful technology. And so enter the automotive industry into biomedical. How did the two of those come together? And I know it has a lot to do with you and your background.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start here. So we've actually had this technology in medical for some time. So we do have another modality of heating, which is called resistive heating, which we are using the same technology that is used in car steering wheels and seats to heat patients. This relies on what's called conductive heat transfer. So it requires very good contact between the patient's body, their skin, and the heating element itself. Whereas with the convective air blowers that are out there, the typical standard of care, they can blow the air, you know, sort of all over the patient's body. So you don't need good contact with that skin, with the blanket itself. So we've developed these other products specifically for these types of situations in the past where it's difficult to use air and we want to, place something underneath the patient or over them that has very good contact with the body. The other nice piece about what Gentherm brings to the table from an automotive standpoint is that we have a technology known as Carbotex. So it's a carbon fiber-based heating element rather than a copper wire. And the reason that's very important in the medical space is because carbon fiber is radiolucent to X-ray. So you will have very often X-ray is used even during general surgery. And the one example that I can come up with is in the case where potentially something may have been left in the body after the surgery is complete, gauze, a needle, something like that. very easy to do, not common, but it does happen. The clinical staff may use x-ray to look for that in the body. And if we had wires and things like that moving all throughout this, those would show up as artifacts in the x-ray and make it a lot harder for the clinicians to go find what they've left in the body. So that's one example of why the x-rays would be there.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So carbon fiber, why doesn't it come up on an x-ray? And how does it conduct heat? I didn't know this about carbon fiber.
Yeah, carbon's a great element, right? So it's the building block of life. So your body and your cells are built on carbon-based elements. And so this is why the x-rays are actually going to work through you, because the carbon is radiolucent, or the carbon-based materials are radiolucent to x-ray. So your bones, which will show up in an x-ray, are not going to see, you will see those types of artifacts and things like that. And that's why they're looking for bone breaks and instances like that when they're running x-rays. In an instance where you've hurt yourself from like for ortho requirements. For us, the copper wires, anything that's metal, is going to absorb those electromagnetic rays. So they do not freely pass through them. And it's because it's an electrical conductor. Generally, electrical conductors and so metals and things like that are going to pick up those electromagnetic rays and not allow them to move through to the detector of the x-ray. But the carbon fiber just happens to be conductive and radiolucent to x-ray, which makes it advantageous for us. The other great thing about carbon fiber in our Carbotex technology is it has a very even heating distribution, okay? So this is typically something that's only used in the higher end cars because it's more expensive, but it does provide a very even heat distribution to the passenger's body. And in this situation, that becomes advantageous to really evenly heat the patient's body as well.
Well, carbon fiber sounds like a win-win situation in the surgical setting for sure. Adam, I'm going to get a little personal here. Adam,
sure.
You hold a PhD in electrical engineering from what I understand, from the University of Cincinnati. So your background is electrical engineering, not medicine. How does an electrical engineer end up designing a device that regulates human body temperature in the operating room setting?
That's a good question, Scott. So I've got a long and storied history. So yes, I actually found medical devices doing my PhD. I had done my internships in the aviation space and actually in jet engines, and thought that's where my career was moving. I received an opportunity to do my PhD in a lab at University of Cincinnati, which sort of fell out of the sky. It wasn't something that I was looking for. But my advisor came to me, explained the project that we were working on, which was going to be sensing biomarkers in human sweat. And that's really where I found developing that technology for inducing sweat, moving sweat, dealing with sweat, and sensing biomarkers in sweat. And eventually pharmaceuticals is where I found the medical industry. And I've never really looked back from there. So I understood that the aviation side of things, and that's affecting and giving back, to society. I've seen that from that industry, but in medical, it is extremely personal. So when you've seen and you've heard those stories, some of the folks that I've worked with in my past have developed medical devices and then had them used on them to save their lives. And you hear these stories and those very personal stories with medical device industry. It's something that I just had to have. So I sort of moved throughout my career into developing different medical devices. I worked in surgical robotics for some time, which can explain my understanding of robotic surgery, and then moved into Gentherm, where I started to understand thermal transfer. So at the end of the day, I don't really consider myself an electrical engineer. I just consider myself just engineer and scientist, because I'm interested in how the world works, how the body works, and how we can solve things. I think the other interesting thing that's a little bit not known about me, Scott, is I actually spent 10 years in the trades before I went to college. So I actually am a journeyman electrician. And so I spent about 7 years doing that. And it's been interesting because I've been able to translate a lot of that knowledge of working with hand tools to watching surgeons use hand tools. And I know it's not the same, it's obviously not the same thing, But I think back to my career as an electrician, where I might have been holding a hot wire that might be, 13,000 volts or more coming from the street, working on it delicately, trying to, cut things off and shave things down and bolt things together. And when I look at surgeons sometimes, I can see the same types of mechanics going on when they're using the tools. So again, not a perfect like-to-like situation, but I'm able to draw those corollaries, understand their pain with working with these tools, and then understand how to, and this is really important, especially in medical device, how to affect and develop tools that fit into their workflow, and you want to make their lives as easy as possible. They don't need to think about working with those tools. They just need to think about, fixing that patient. And that's our goal.
Well, Adam, it really sounds like during your academic career, you were sweating the details.
That's, I like it, Scott. Yeah. We had plenty of puns about sweat, Scott. I'm sure that, we needed to add that to the list. So I'm going to have to call up my old colleagues and throw that one on the list.
There you go.
Yeah.
I give it to you as a gift for being here on the interview with us today. But Adam, I recently had a little bit of shoulder pain. So I got the old heating pad out and put the heating pad on my skin and ouch. I mean, that's really kind of hard to regulate. You can end up maybe with a minor burn or some irritation. What's the biggest engineering challenge in keeping heat delivery so precise and safe when it's in direct sustained contact with the human skin?
As I mentioned before, the great thing about Carbotex is it's very evenly heated. So we know that when we sense the heat of the device in one place, we have sensors actually on the device, almost directly down on the heating element, but closer up actually to the patient to be able to control that. We're very sure that the rest of the device is at that exact temperature because of that even heat distribution of the carbon fiber. But beyond that, we also work under very strict standards in medical device. So, this might be a little bit too in the weeds, but there is a standard known as IEC 60601, which deals with with safety of in electrical systems for medical device. And you'd be hard pressed to find a medical device engineer that didn't know something about that standard or hadn't heard about it, because it covers a lot of different things. For us, we have a particular part of that standard which deals with warming devices, and there are standards for how warm we can get the skin and what our accuracy has to be on these conductive heat transfer devices. So we design everything specifically for that standard. We don't bring it up over the thresholds that they allow because of the work that's been done in the past that would show, hey, if I get over this said temperature, there could be a risk of a burn coming later on. But where the automotive side of this comes in and really starts to collide, and the beautiful part about automotive being that, although it's a regulated industry, the design and innovation cycles are a lot faster. And so a lot of innovation has occurred. And as you can think of, just, if you think of our heating elements being out there in cars as sort of being a pretest for putting them into a medical device, our engineering teams have decades of experience in learning how to control those devices, very tightly control them in a safe manner, and make sure that the surfaces of the device, not the heating element itself, which is buried behind layers of foam and other materials, that the surface itself is exactly at the temperature that we would like to control it to.
Adam, I'm wondering, no doubt you've spent quite a bit of time in the operating room. What's the genesis, really? Is it the surgeon or the clinician that says, gosh, it'd be really nice if we could XYZ? I mean, I know that I can tell you're such a creative person, but, or was it the people in charge of keeping people warm in the operating room that said, if only we didn't have to use the, what we've been using?
We do everything by voice of customer. So we want, as you said, Len, we want to get out there. We want to understand the gaps in the market, in the surgical space, and figure out how we can go solve them. I think that's a really important thing about how we operate at Gentherm Medical is, obviously, we want to take our automotive technology and put it into the medical space, but we don't start on that technical side. We don't start, hey, we have this solution, let's go find a place to put it. We go out and find gaps, and then we say, hey, do we have the technology to do this? Can we develop the technology to do this? And then go solve that problem. I think that's a key for us and the reason why we're successful in what we do. So with this device, the way I think about our devices and patient warming is we're solving a problem that is, it's not secondary, but it's a side effect of doing the surgery. So you're having a surgery for a different reason, right? So that, and that surgeon is worried about what's going on inside that patient and what they're trying to fix. So ideally, you know, the actual surgeon themselves were, although they are worried about patient warming and all of the complications that can occur from a patient going hypothermic, they're typically not the ones that we're getting the feedback from. We're getting the feedback from nurses and anesthesiologists, okay? Mm-hmm. So the nurses are the folks, and we talk to a lot of them that are in charge of patient safety. As we heard from our VOC and from our focus groups, we constantly hear the term do no harm. And they're worried about everything that could go wrong on that patient during the surgery, pressure injuries, hypothermia, patient slipping, all of those different things, what's inside the, is what's going on through the patient or the nurse's mind and trying to keep keep that patient safe during the surgery. And then the other person being the anesthesiologist who, the anesthesiologists own the patient's temperature because of the fact that the anesthesia medicines are what affects the patient's temperature. The anesthesiologist is ultimately responsible for that as well. Mm-hmm. So they'll operate our devices, make sure our devices, the nurses are going to be setting the devices up, getting the patients on to them, turning them on. But ultimately the anesthesiologist is the person that's going to be running the machine and responsible for making sure that the patient's temperature is staying what we call normothermic or staying above hypothermic. So ultimately, that's the duos that we're going out there talking to and trying to get feedback from to make their lives easier at the end of the day.
I didn't think I'd feel like I could go on asking you questions for the next couple of hours, but I do feel that way. However, we have to wrap. But before we let you go, I do want to ask you, you know, because you're in this world of wearable biosensors and things like that, you can see here I have my Aura ring on.
Oh, cool.
And which I feel like I live and die by, really. And I'm wondering what you think in general of being that this is part of your background, all these wearable devices that we have that are charting all kinds of things like our, you know, body temperature and our sleep and you know, what are your thoughts?
It's an interesting space. It's been a while since I've been in it. The interesting thing about me, Lynn, is I don't wear any of them. I've always said in the past, I love doing it and I see where they're going. I see the benefit of them in improving people's lives, right? I mean, eventually these things, we were looking at one point at, we were looking at sensing pharmaceuticals, specifically opioids in human beings. And the idea was that we could measure the opioid level, measure your particular metabolism and how you metabolize that particular drug so that physicians, they could see that in real time and make dosage prescriptions based on your particular physiology instead of what's done there out there right now, which is these sort of, you know, huge clinical trials with generalized patients into this group. You know, I'm male, I'm between the ages of 40 and 50. This is your dosage. That was the idea of where it could go. I see a huge benefit in that going forward. And so specifically, you know, in medicine. And I think for the general consumer too, it's not that I'm against these things, but measuring your steps, measuring your heart rate when you're working out, those types of things. It's interesting for me in general is the way that I looked at it is I don't want to measure every little aspect of my life and sort of be answering to myself like I'm, you know, like I'm my own boss and I have to get these things done in my personal life. So outside of, you know, the workspace, those particular things never really rang as useful to me, but 100% I agree and see where the and see the benefit that those are going to provide for people.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, you don't want to bring your day job home with you every night, right?
No. That's right. That's right.
All right. Well, yeah. Adam Hauke is our guest. He leads the development of next generation medical devices at Gentherm Medical. What a fascinating conversation and a surprising one. Adam, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Lynn, Scott, thank you so much for the outlet. I really enjoyed myself.